Well, as we said, James Foley was working as a freelance journalist for Global Post and other organizations when he was taken hostage in Syria by ISIS, raising a lot of questions about freelance journalists working in dangerous places and what responsibilities that news organizations have for them. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us, as he regularly does, from New York. David, welcome.
Hey, guys.
Well, and can you give us a sense, first of all, of the overall picture, not just freelance journalists, but how many journalists are killed each year in conflict zones around the world?
Well, there are a couple different ways to measure it. But if you take the Committee to Protect Journalists, a respected outfit, it argues or it counts 70 journalists killed in 2013 around the world, the largest single number of them killed in Syria. So far in 2014, it counts 32 journalists killed so far. Another institute based in London, the International News Safety Institute, claims 79 dead. Regardless of what number you use, and there are different ways of accounting for people, it can be very, very dangerous, particularly if you think about Syria, Gaza, Israel, and in recent years, of course, Afghanistan and Iraq as well.
Now, David, obviously this isn't a new situation, the death and hostage-taking of journalists. I mean, James Foley himself had been taken hostage in Libya and then released. So in other situations where that has happened, how have news organizations handled it?
Well, there are different ways of doing it, of course. There are a number of questions. Part of it is what the captors are demanding, or at least claim to be demanding. Oftentimes they will make garish and outlandish demands for ransom, as in the case of David Rode, who was taken as a journalist for The New York Times and an author while reporting in Afghanistan some years ago. There are often efforts to try to raise money to pay ransoms by the news organizations. There are efforts to work through diplomatic channels and back channels through American authorities as well. Those two things don't work in concert. Because it's not legal to pay money to terrorists, organizations officially designated as terrorists in this country. But, you know, there are desperate efforts to figure out ways to get people out. Sometimes there have been the British launched several years ago an armed effort that successfully liberated a British reporter and journalist for The New York Times, although I believe his Afghan associate was killed in the process.
Right.
So these are tricky choices that have to be made by families, by news organizations, and as well by governments.
Doesn't it even get more tricky when we're talking about freelance journalists who aren't – they're working for news organizations, but they're not official employees of those news organizations?
Right. So there's some complicating things there. You know, Global Post, for which James Foley was doing reporting at the time he was seized, has taken – you know, took Foley's case very seriously and appears to have been treated him as one of their own. They're also freelancers and freelancers. You can think of people like Barton Gellman, who won a Pulitzer for his reporting on the Snowden documents for The Washington Post, is essentially a freelancer contracted to work for The Washington Post rather than a full-time employee at that newspaper. Almost a distinction without a difference. There are also freelancers who are already present in conflict zones or near them and travel there essentially what we call on spec, which is to say they say, we're here, we can send stories back, we've worked together in the past, or you know of my work, why not pick up some piece from me, help subsidize what I do? And in those cases, you know, news organizations haven't been involved on the front end to train people, to equip them, to ensure that they're ready for the challenges that occurred. I talked to Hannah Storm, the executive director of the International News Safety Institute in London. And she said, you know, it's hard to prevent journalists from doing that in part because news organizations themselves have downsized so much and have there's so many fewer foreign bureaus and a lot of mainstream news organizations that once had them. And because, among other things, equipment is so much cheaper in terms of capturing text and video and sending it back home for rebroadcast, republication, that people can just take a lot more initiative than they once did. And so freelancers are often there because they want to be there. They want to, you know, bear testimony and tell the world what happens, but news organizations have done a very good job, I'm told, in training and preparing their full-time employees, their long-time contract freelancers for things. But for freelancers themselves, they often go there without the training, the protection, and the ability to foresee what's going to happen nearly as well.
Well, and that doesn't look like it's likely to change at all now, David, because as you said, foreign bureaus are not as big or as plentiful as they used to be, and these news organizations are relying a lot more on freelancers. Do you see that changing at all? Post James Foley's death?
I think a lot of things are coming into question thanks to James Foley's death and the international attention that it garnered. I think from the practices in the newsroom to expectations, I don't know that freelancers aren't going to be a thing, but you may see changes in terms of both newsroom practices and also governmental policies. One thing David Rhodes said to leave you with, he said, look, Americans don't – the government will not pay any ransom money as a policy. European governments will. And that distinction essentially creates a gap through which American journalists taken captive are at far greater risk than their European counterparts.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joining us from New York. David, thank you.
You bet.